You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We've heard many stories about Motown through the years. You've heard stories of its stars or the story of the ambitious Berry Gordy Jr. using an $800 family loan to build one of the most impactful record labels anywhere. But there's a side to this story that we haven't heard much about until now, the business side, the entrepreneurial spirit, the hustle to get the records played and the company paid. That's the story told in a stunning new book called Motown, The Sound of Young America. It's co-authored by Adam White and Berry Gordy's right-hand man, Barney Ailes. Music journalist Adam White was editor-in-chief of Billboard. He's written for Rolling Stone, Radio and Records, The Times, and many, many more publications. Adam, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And we welcome a legendary name in Motown history, Berry Gordy's right-hand man, Barney Ailes, the Detroiter who led Motown's sales team and from 1975 to 78 was president of Motown. Barney Ailes, such a pleasure to have you with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much. Nice talking to you.
This is truly a spectacular book, both the history you tell us, but the unbelievable photos of the people and the artists who made Motown what it is. And I know a lot of these no one's ever seen before. Adam, what was your goal for this book and the story that you really wanted to get out there?
Well, the goal really was to tell, as you mentioned earlier, the stories that haven't been told. I call them the backroom believers. Barney was the king of the backroom believers. These were the people behind the company who helped build that business, without whom it wouldn't have been a business, it wouldn't have been a viable company. And I think, you know, there have been many books written about Motown. I can say this because I've got them all. And I know, you know, the artists have written their autobiographies, many stories have been told, but not these stories. And that's what both Barney and I wanted to do, was to add to the sum of knowledge of Motown, to allow people to understand how it was as a business and how it evolved and how it changed people's lives, both the people who work there and the people who listen to the music. So that and the power of the images, because music is always first, but you can never forget with those Motown stars the imagery, the how they look, just the style, the class, the sparkle, which made a difference, made everything. And that's what we try to capture in the book, too.
Well, it's amazing, Adam. You comment in the book how good Barney's recollection was of everything.
And that was the goal, really. I mean, for me, the beauty of being able to ask Barney, who was right at the center of gravity, every question as a Motown fanboy I ever wanted to ask. And because I had an aunt who lived in the U.S. when I was in England, who could send me copies of Billboard, for example, the trade magazine, and I would get to see there was another world to this company and to this business. And that's what drew me in. So when I had the opportunity really to sort of interrogate Barney and ask him all of those questions, who were these people? Who were the promotion guys? Who were the distributors? What was it like? How hard was it? How was it like getting paid? What made a difference? Who were the people who really influenced things? And that, for me, was wonderful. And I hope and think for Barney, you felt the same, because it was kind of like you got to tell me about all these people you knew who mostly nobody really knew anything about but were absolutely vital to the story and the evolution of the business.
Barney, you accepted Berry Gordy's offer to join Motown really early on, 1961. Why was that? What was it about Berry Gordy that made you go, yep, I'm joining up?
Well, actually, I had a distributorship in Detroit with another gentleman by the name of Harvey Kahn, Henry Droz, and Johnny Kaplan. I met Berry at a radio station and knew nothing about his background, and we just started talking, and then he invited me to go over to the studio, and I went by there, and we just became kind of close friends before I joined him. Then was a problem of worrying about whether our friendship was going to go. You know, it's very hard to work with somebody. And I said, well, let me think about it. I talked to my wife, and I decided that this would be the time to go. A lot of people don't realize is Berry's background of being a writer with Jackie Wilson and before and stuff like that, and the background that I had with before the distributorship, which had a bunch of labels prior to being with Warner Brothers, that I was a branch manager of Warner Brothers Records when they came out by themselves. And before that, I was with Capitol Records and from 55 on. So it just didn't happen overnight. I mean, there's a background of knowing the music business and what to look for and what to do.
And Cynthia, that was absolutely critical to the success of Motown at that point, because Barney had those relationships, you know, with those people from his time at Capitol and Warner's and his time at Aurora that gave him the connections and the contacts to help Motown build a business at a critical time. And so there he is, you know, he drops names like Henry Drosen, Johnny Kaplan, and Harvey Kahn. Those were people whose names I kind of like, who are these guys? And I knew they were vital to the Detroit music business. But when you have an opportunity to understand the roles they played and their relationship with Barney and how that all fell into place to really put fuel into Motown's tank in a business sense, that was absolutely critical.
And understanding as we read the book and get the sense of history, and certainly there's no escaping the issue of race in telling the story of Motown. In fact, you open the book with the 1967 Detroit riots. Barney, your Sicilian background, the sales team you led at Motown was white. Is that, and the connections you had, is that what it took in the early 60s to open the proverbial doors of the industry to Berry Gordy and Motown?
I think it was more the idea of knowing how to work with distributors and radio stations. I mean, the background of collecting the money was the point of being Sicilian. That people weren't never too sure what my connections were with whatever you want to call the organization, mob, Casa Nostra, stuff like that.
Right.
And I never would tell people one way or the other what the connection was. But I started in the record business at Capitol Records in 55 because I wanted to get married at that time and I needed a job because prior to that I was with my godfather in construction. Mm-hmm. But the main point, what I was trying to bring out, was that I started in the back room as a stock boy at 75 cents an hour. And so, and they told me, well, that's the way you'd move up into Capitol Records, which I did eventually. I became, besides assistant branch manager, I became one of the main salesmen. They're working myself up to that, and also a promotion manager in the Capitol at Detroit and the area.
So there you are, Cynthia. There was an Italian-American guy. Before he joined the music business, he was good with cement.
You know, Adam, you share with us in the book an anecdote about Barry and Barney going to dinner at Detroit's London Chop House. Will you recap that for us and what that said to you about that time in history and these two men?
Well, it was a pretty extraordinary story. And I guess, you know, they, as Barney's explained, you know, they were friends, their wives were friends, they had a great personal relationship. So the four of them go off to dinner at the Chop House. And Barney, I know you knew the owner, but he wasn't there that night. So the woman at the desk, when the four of you showed up, two white, two black, and she said, you know, I'm sorry, we don't serve colored people. And Barney shot back, that's good, we don't eat them. And, you know, it's like a music hall line, except that it's not funny.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it wasn't funny at the time.
No.
It was scary.
I bet. You were there.
Yeah, I was quite embarrassed and because I knew the owner of Chop House, and I used to go there quite a bit. I didn't think there would be a problem whatsoever. Then I saw the look on their face, and it's when I heard her say, well, we don't serve colored people. I became very Sicilian.
You went Sicilian on her, ma'am.
And again, you can't believe that people would say stuff like that, but it just reveals much about the times.
Well, it's fascinating to me, and you know, listening to your accent, Adam, we know where you grew up. How important for Motown was the fact that the label was and is so hugely popular in England? I know that Martha Reeves told me when I interviewed her in the 90s how she always got a huge, huge welcome going to England, still does. We have relatives coming next week from London to visit Detroit for the first time. What do you want to see? Hitsville. That's tops. Why is that, you think? Why that connection?
Well, I mean, first of all, the power of the music. The music was extraordinary, no matter by any standard. But in Britain particularly, it carried extra weight because there was nothing like it locally. I mean, I joke that when I was growing up, look, the first Motown record I heard, and it changed my life, was Heatwave by Martha and the Vandellas. And I'd never heard anything like it. Now, if I turn on the radio at that time at home, you know, I could hear the Beatles. So I turn on my TV set, I could see the Rolling Stones. I could care less. You know, they were too accessible. It was too obvious. There was this other thing. What was this music coming from Detroit? Where the hell is Detroit? What is Detroit? What is Motown? And I think for a lot of kids my age, that was something. It was the romance of the distant. So it had an extra cachet. It had something, as well as the power of the music. I mean, you're listening to Heatwave or Can I Get a Witness by Marvin Gaye or music like that, and it really was unlike anything else you could hear. And it clearly affected the Beatles. I mean, the Beatles covered three Motown songs on an early album. So I think there was that devotion to the music that was coupled by the exotic nature of where it came from. And then it started to embed itself into British popular culture. But the interesting thing was that the tour of 1965, when the Motown package tour came over, was not a hit. Even though the Supremes had had a couple of hit records at that time in the UK, nobody knew who these other artists were. Nobody knew who Stevie was or Martha or the Miracles. So the tour was not a commercial success. But within a year, the music had started to take root and build up a following. And so in a way, Britain was late, but then it became more loyal. The love went deeper. And look, some of the artists found more success in Britain. Jimmy Ruffin, for example.
Yes. Well, it was stunning to me as I read your book, Motown, The Sound of Young America, that comment, you quote Mary Wilson, and the impact that it had being in Britain on the Motown artist. And she said, in England, treated like royalty while at home, we weren't black, we were Negroes.
The one thing, a wonderful thing, was connections that I had with EMI, who was very influential in building the label throughout all of Europe. They used to have parties at EMI House with a lot of those pictures where they came from and stuff like that. The idea of sending the groups and all the artists to England on that tour was the same thing that we did in America. Where I got the idea was of sending them across the country and teaching them is when I was at Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers had a television station. They had all the kooky Sunset Strip.
Ed Burns, yes.
Yeah, right. And they sent them around the country promoting ABC and all the shows on Warner Brothers. And then Barry and I sat, and I said, you know, what a great idea if we send the people around. It's going to help me as far as the distributors and radio stations are concerned when they see exactly how great we are. And that's what we did, the same thing in England. And Adam's completely right. It wasn't a winner at the beginning, but it sure became afterwards.
And here's the thing, the relationship that you, Barney, had with EMI and all the international EMI people around Europe also played a role in this book, in that EMI has this fabulous archive of pictures. They kept a proper archive of all of their stuff, paperwork as well as photos, so that when it came to researching and putting this book together, because it was, you know, authorized and approved by Universal Music, which now owns the Motown catalog, we got into the Hayes Library and we got those pictures. And they're some of the ones that have never been seen before. And again, it just shows how international that company was, its impact was, but the source of some of those images was from outside the U.S., and they speak volumes, too.
They're amazing. Well, for anybody who ever felt that wonderful chill down their backbone at the first note of any Motown song, this book is an absolute must. It is Motown, The Sound of Young America, co-authored by music journalist Adam White and Barry Gordy's right-hand man, Barney Ailes, the fellow that turned that chemistry of Studio A into the color of money. It was fabulous to meet both of you. I'm sure that those 18 months of Skype calls were fascinating. You made us feel like we were in on it with you. Thank you very much, Barney and Adam, for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.